So the format for today's review session is just we're going to begin by asking for any general questions you guys have on the course material. And then our first seven or so slides are the topics of the course broken down by lecture recap. So just to sort of jog your memory and see if there are any other topics you want to make sure we cover. And then after that, we'll just dive into a review that we've prepared, and we'll make sure while doing that to cover any topics that you guys have mentioned. Sound good? So to begin, anything you want to make sure that we talk about today?
Okay, so first things first, the scope of the exam, from first lesson to...
Yes, so the exam, the question was about the scope of the exam, and it's non-cumulative. So we'll cover materials, lectures 5 through 9, meaning the things that are pictures and audiovisual up through today's lecture on JavaScript and Scratch. Any other general questions? It'll be similar to the first exam, so as some people have told me, long, and really does test all of the concepts we've covered, but hopefully also doable, and with a fun Grumpy Cat reference in there, I'm sure, as well. Yes, we'll talk about those today. So RJ is going to start making a list of topics we want to be sure to cover. We'll put ciphers right on there. Concrete list of topics.
Yeah, so just like last time, we'll have like a list of things you know and things like
that. Okay. Yes, so Tommy is going to prepare another for the camera, another list of topics that will be covered on the exam and things that won't be covered on the exam. And that will be posted soon. Any other specific topics, or shall we dive in? So we'll just display the next slide. So we began lecture 5 by talking about graphics. And these are some of the things we talked about: raster and vector graphics, additive and subtractive color mixing, lossy lossless compression, image formats, also file formats, and scene carving. Are there any of these topics in particular that we should? All right, we'll just keep running through these slides, and if you see something that you want to make sure we talk about, hopefully we'll be able to talk about everything, but just go ahead and call it out if there's something that you want to make sure we cover. So, sampling, analog waves, MP3s, graphics. Keep her going. Online security. Anything? Do we remember what sessions are? SQL injections?
Yeah, SQL injections.
SQL injections would be a good thing to talk about?
Yeah.
Yes. No, that's one of the more complex things that we talked about, in my opinion. Talked about data security, and we're going to talk about, in this encryption section, we'll talk about our two ciphers, asymmetric key encryption. Does everyone remember that? We'll talk about it. All right.
Yeah.
I just had a quick question.
Yeah.
Forensics as applied to the hard drive.
Yes. So forensics in this context is recovering data from a hard drive or even RAM.
Yeah, so we'll be sure to go over as much of this as possible, and we'll post these slides online. But anything in particular that you want us to make sure we talk about, definitely let us know.
Yeah. And we had a couple emails before class today of topics that we'll have to make sure to cover. I think those related to CSS in particular, so we'll be doing that as well. And then the last thing we did before HTML and CSS was design. Any specific design things we should be sure to talk about? All right, well, let's get it started. We began with graphics. Oh, let's go one more slide. And we talked about raster and vector graphics. Can anyone tell me what raster graphics was?
So, like the basic type of graphics where you have a set of grids that are defined by the color.
Exactly. So we have some grid or set of grids in which we have many different squares. Each square has one color. We refer to that as a pixel. And the alternative was this vector graphics, where we use some mathematical equation to store our image data. And the simple example that Tommy gave was if we wanted to define a circle, we could use the mathematical equation x squared plus y squared equals r, which is the equation for a circle. And therefore, it allows us to scale up much more easily, because to make a bigger circle, we can just make a bigger value for r. Any questions on this so far? That makes sense to everybody. So as we said, vector graphics are much easier to scale than raster graphics. But then you might say, once we move into more complicated things than a circle, how will we use vector graphics to define an image? And so the practice is just to define multiple control points and multiple equations going through those control points.
And I should just say, as we keep going through these things, and as you, you know, ultimately end up studying later this week or this weekend, always feel free to post questions on Discuss. So for those in the room and also those watching this video at home, you know, this is not your last time to ask us questions. As things come up, post them on Discuss, and we'll be sure to answer them as quickly as we can. And that would probably be one of the best ways to sort of confirm your knowledge about something or fill in a gap where you just don't, you're studying and you're just not sure how these pieces fit together.
Great. So we then talked about additive and subtractive color mixing. Additive color mixing being when we start with a black background, you could say, and then sort of add colors of light to create the final color that we want. So as we learned on, or were tested on our problem set, the primary set of colors for that could be RGB. So if we just shine red light, we get a red image. If we shine red and green light, we get another color. Then we talked about subtractive color mixing, in which instead of starting with black and just adding colors, we started with white and subtracted some colors. So for instance, we saw that cyan absorbs red and yellow absorbs blue. So if we mix cyan and yellow in this subtractive color mixing, we'll actually end up with green because we absorb all the red and all the blue, and we're just left with green. So two different models for representing colors. And the primary colors for subtractive color mixing were cyan, magenta, and yellow. We then moved on to lossy and lossless data compression. Lossless compression being when we compress an image, but sort of just use tricks so that we maintain all of the data from the original image file. And the example we talked about was a flag when we had big stripes of the same color. So instead of saying, this is a white pixel, this is a white pixel, this is a white pixel, say, the next 1,000 pixels are all white. And you can see how that might take up less space and thus give us some compression. But then lossy compression goes further. It might use tricks like that, but then it also actually throws away some of the data found in the original image in the interest of further compression. And please do stop me at any time if you would like some clarification or have questions.
Yeah, so if I had a file, like an image file that was, you know, 1 megabyte, and then I showed you two compressed files that were half a megabyte and a quarter of a megabyte, which type of compression does it seem like we used for those two files?
So I think the question is, if we have one that was reduced down to a quarter of a meg and one that is reduced to half a meg, which one used lossy, which one used lossless?
Okay. I would say the quarter meg used lossy, and then the half a meg probably used lossless.
Right, because there's only so much we can... Oh, yeah, so the answer that was given was that the half meg would probably be lossless, and the quarter meg would be lossy. There's only so much that you can conserve with these tricks, and then if you want to get any smaller, you really have to start throwing away data. Now, of course, they could both be lossy or both be lossless, but if I promised you that one was one and one was the other, then yes, the bigger one would be lossless, and the smaller one would be lossy.
Yes. And then we talked about a few different file formats that use these different types of compression. So we started with the bitmap file, a .bmp, that actually uses no compression. That was our most simple example of raster graphics. Then we talked about GIFs and PNGs, both of which use lossless data compression, and then moved on to JPEGs, which use lossy data compression. Any questions on these things? Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But GIMP wasn't a category that was on there. PNG wasn't a category to save it in on GIMP. You know, to save the logo itself, because I wanted to download Photoshop, but Photoshop's a really big problem.
Yes, sure.
But I downloaded GIMP and I tried to save the logo in PNG, but it wouldn't let me do it. It would only let me do it in a GIF file.
Yeah, so the question for the camera was about GIMP and about these different file formats, and one student here had used GIMP and was trying to save as a PNG, but could only seem to save it as a .GIF. And so the answer there is different programs allow you to save in different formats. I think with GIMP in particular, you can save by default in this XCF format. And if you want to save in other file formats, like a JPEG or a GIF or a PNG, you have to, in GIMP in particular, do something special, like go to File, Export, or Edit, Save As, and it's different in every program. I think GIMP allows you to export into different file formats, so I think if you do File, Export in GIMP, it'll let you make a PNG. I could be wrong. I know that by default, it's going to save as this XCF or this weird...
I saved it as XCF.
Yeah, the weird format. When you sent it to me, I opened it as in GIMP, and it opened fine. Different programs have different default formats and different formats they can handle and different formats they can export to. So Microsoft Word can save as a .doc or a .docx, and it can save a copy as a PDF, for example. Like, Word can't open PDF, but Word can export to PDF. It can make a copy of a current document as a PDF, and different programs just do things differently. So that GIMP handles it a certain way, and Photoshop handles it slightly differently.
So we then moved on to our AV topics, if you want to move one further. And we started talking about analog waves and how we can represent analog waves with digital sounds, or a digital representation. So our question was, how do we go from this continuous analog function to some digital ones and zeros? And our solution was to take samples along the curves. Can anyone tell me what a sample is? Not too difficult, maybe.
The number of the bits.
Yeah, so it's not even quite that complex yet. But if we have some sort of wave like this, and then we say we're going to sample at this point, so now we've stored some data on our computer about what the sound looks like at this point. So the thing that we then introduced was a sampling rate. So if I wanted to model this entire analog curve with just that one point, it wouldn't do a very good job, right? Because this stores no data about what the sound looks like over here. So then we introduced more samples, one over here, one over here. And then the more samples we introduce, the better our representation, but also the more space it takes up. So the sampling rate, then, is just the number of samples we take from the curve. And then I think, as Chris was getting at, the bit rate is the number of bits we use to represent each sample. Any questions on this material? No? OK. So we then talked about MP3 files. And we talked about how that the songs stored in the MP3 file format take up about a tenth of the space as things stored in CD quality, or PCM. And the way that MP3 compresses is by taking advantage of the phenomenon known as psychoacoustics. So psychoacoustics is just some things that about human biology, such as humans can't hear certain frequencies, or if two similar frequencies are created at the same time, you won't hear the lower one. And so MP3 simply says, all right, if humans can't hear this sound, we're going to throw it away. Or if this sound is masked by another frequency, we'll throw that away. And in that way, MP3s use psychoacoustics to compress sound files. Question?
I'm just going to say, kind of to make like a rough analogy, it's like the auditory equivalent of glossy compression.
Would you agree with that analogy, RJ?
Let's repeat it for the camera. So the question for the camera was, is this, you know, kind of a rough analogy to the what we saw in images with lossy compression.
If it helps you to think of it in that way, then I would say yes, because it is compressing. And I think actually you are correct. It throws away some data that was originally there, but hopefully the quality is still preserved. So yes. All right. Our next AV topic was 3D graphics. So we talked about wireframes, meshes, and subdividing. A wireframe was just when we create a model that defines the edges of a 3D object. So we define some points in 3D space, and then the lines that connect those points. And those lines we saw in our recap, I believe, an image of a panda bear. And the lines around the panda bear could be curved. Then when we moved on to a mesh, which is a type of wireframe where each component is a polygon, that means our lines can no longer be curved, they have to be straight. And the example there was this cool polygonally created dolphin. Then subdivision is a little different. It was a technique we used to smooth surfaces, which is a little vague perhaps, but we saw the example of the diamond ring that initially started out as sort of a big blocky box for the gold band, and then a diamond that didn't really look like a diamond. But then subdivision took each polygon and subdivided it into multiple smaller polygons. And through that way, we started with a flat surface and then made it several curved surfaces. And then from there, we could smooth out those surfaces more and eventually get a truly smooth, curved 3D surface. We then talked about video. We talked about codecs, containers, and compression. So containers are the things you may have seen before. Those are the files that store sort of all of the video data, like your video files, your audio files, your movie menu, and your subtitles. And the codec is a program that compresses or decompresses video. And we talked about a standard of doing that, which was H.264, or also known as AVC. Any questions on those two things, the difference between the two? Nope, OK. And then we talked about compression. And the method of compressing a video file that we talked about was just storing the changes between different scenes. So if you think of one scene with, because this is CSE1 led by Tommy McWilliam, a cat in it. And maybe over here we have a chair, and on the other side we have a cat, and it's rolling around, it's doing something adorable. It's moving, but the chair isn't. So between different scenes of this video, we can just sort of throw away the chair, because it's not changing between the different scenes. So the only data we need to keep around is how the cat is moving. And that allows us to throw away a little data and save some space. Questions on this process? No, we're OK? Great.
On the same vein as JPEG.
Exactly. Yes, similar to JPEG's lossy compression. We then talked about video streaming, which you guys may have used on a website like Hulu or YouTube, in which we start playing a video before the entire file is downloaded. So the way this is done is by downloading the upcoming minutes into a buffer. So while we're on minute 3, hopefully we're downloading minute 4. If this doesn't work, then you get stuck with those screens that say buffering while more of the video file is downloaded. So it's not always a perfect system, but it does allow us to begin playing a video sooner than we otherwise would be able to. In this section of the lecture recap, we also talked about aspect ratios, which are just the ratios between width and height in various resolutions. So I'm sure the 1080 by 720 resolutions are familiar to you guys. And then the aspect ratio is just the ratio between those two numbers. Common ones are 16:9 or 4:3. And then we talked about adaptive bitrate streaming, in which the server decides which resolution is best for you. So it thinks your connection is too slow, so it's going to send you a lower resolution that takes up less space. If it's really high quality, it'll send you very high quality video.
So before we dive into this next topic, I thought I'd take a second and talk about study tips. I definitely recommend the recaps are a great resource. Now, when you go over the recaps, make sure you sort of cross-reference it with the list of topics for the exam so that you're not, you feel free to learn as much as you want, but you're not memorizing or studying necessarily the things that are not going to be covered on the exam. But on the recaps, a lot of the words are in bold, things like compression or lossy compression, these sort of terms. So those are particularly useful to learn and to know. So they're in bold, there's probably a story associated with them. If we asked you to describe, what lossy compression means, we often give an example of an image that could be compressed in a lossless or lossy way. So definitely go through the recaps, they're a great resource. If there's something in particular that you see, you read the story that's listed with it, you don't quite understand it, maybe go to the lecture video that covered it, and you can search through the lecture transcript to find that component. And if still then, having watched the lecture video, something still doesn't quite make sense, feel free again to just ask us questions on Discuss. We really want to make sure you understand this before going into the exam. But the recaps are a great resource. And the section videos are also fun for reinforcing these things, but the recaps and the lecture videos, I think, should be the first sort of method for studying. And if there's something else, you feel free to Google it or go on Wikipedia if the resources we provide don't fully explain something in a way that makes sense.
And RJ just described my method of preparing for this presentation. Start with the recaps, move on to the lecture videos if I can't remember what something is. So online security was our next topic. We began by talking about sessions, but to build up to the topic of sessions, we introduced authentication and cookies. So authentication is just how we authenticate and say that we are who we say we are. And on the internet, we often do this by providing a username and a password. But then servers will often store cookies on our machines, which are just small text files, so that they can better remember who it is that we are. And the way that sessions make use of this is through a unique identifier for our specific browsing session. So if RJ and I are both on some website like Facebook, then maybe I get the ID 123, RJ gets the ID 456. So then for every action that I make, instead of having to enter in my username and password again, I can just send along in an HTTP request this unique identifier. So I can pass along my string of 123, and with that way, Facebook can say, oh, 123, that's Ben, and know that I am, in fact, who I say I am. Now, for those of you who really know your stuff, you'll remember that this leads to some vulnerabilities in the CSERF attack, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Questions on what these things are? Important topics?
Maybe the big section over there, all of our adoring fans?
No. Oh, anything?
No, okay.
They're quiet. They're very smart people. We then talked about HTTPS, a way of securing traffic when sending it to a website. So the S is for secure, HTTP secure, and it uses a layer on top of HTTP known as the secure socket layer. And that encrypts the data before sending it to the server. So our previous HTTP protocol was to sort of write the request, send it off, and some server receives the request and interprets it, does what it will. But now we add this extra step. So we write the request, and then we encrypt it. And we send off the encrypted version. So if any bad guy grabs it on the way, they just get this encrypted HTTP request, which they hopefully don't know how to decrypt. And then when the request reaches the server, before they can read it, they decrypt it, but hopefully they know the key. And so for this reason, servers have to explicitly support HTTPS. So I can't, unfortunately, just go to https://cse1.net, because if I started sending them an encrypted HTTP request, they wouldn't actually know how to interpret it. So servers have to be ready, and they have to support HTTPS to be able to decrypt our encrypted messages.
Oh, any question on that? Or
yeah. Just go ahead and do you have something?
It was just going to be a question about proprietary servers being ones that would have that set up. Like, I'm just thinking, you know, the bank.
Yes. So hopefully the question was about proprietary servers that may have this set up. So services like Facebook and Google will all support this, as far as I know. And then hopefully things like banks, as you were saying, do support this, because we don't want to be sending our bank account numbers and passwords and information in an unsafe manner. And then another way, parallel to HTTPS, is Wi-Fi security. So you can use both of them, you can use one of them or the other. But Wi-Fi just allows you to encrypt all of the traffic on a network. And I talked about this a lot in my section video, but it was covered briefly in lecture just in the context of there are these technologies known as WEP and WPA and WPA2 that you can use to encrypt all the traffic on your network. So WEP was cracked, so I would advise any of you who are currently using it to stop. But WPA was then a follow-up, and then WPA2 was another iteration of WPA. So the most recent and the standard safe encryptor to use.
And there are two types of WPA, right? WPA2, right?
Yes, so WPA and WPA2.
There are two types of WPA2, right?
Yes, so we didn't get into any more. Oh, the question was, are there more types, a second type of WPA2? And I believe so, but for our purposes, we sort of just introduced these terms and didn't even get too much into the differences between them. So then we got into a relatively complex topic, that of databases. So a database just being several tables, one or more tables, where each table consists of some columns and some rows. The columns define what information we're going to store, and the rows define the values for that information. So for instance, if we're designing the Facebook, as I did a few years ago under the alias Mark Zuckerberg, we might want to store someone's ID and username and email address. So those would be the columns. And then for all our different users, we would have rows storing those values. So in my row, it would have the ID 1, because I was the first one to use the Facebook, and then my email address, Ben Schrei@rjaquino.net or whatever, and my password. And the way we interact with databases is through this language called SQL, or structured query language. And we saw these sort of funky syntactical markers, things like select, insert, update, and delete. And we did go into a fair bit of detail with these things, so I would encourage you to look back at the recaps and definitely feel comfortable reading and writing SQL queries. So things like select star from some table, know what that means, or delete everything. Know why the XKCD comic is funny. I guess that's more about SQL injection. But the point is, if you have any questions about the format of SQL, how we write it, now would be a great time to ask, and it is an important concept. Yeah?
So, yeah, this, I haven't done any SQL.
This is when it gets, yeah, sure.
So this is kind of, is there any other resource, or before I go to the resource, how far do you want us to take this? Should we be able to, you know, code our whole, I mean, how far, you know,
Tommy, do we have the question was how much SQL do we expect you to know? Do you have any specific information?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that we cover in lecture, just like the basics, like
yes.
Recognizing what a select query looks like and like what a query will do. And then as far as injections, like why specifying certain inputs will work, like what they will do to the query. But you don't, okay. You know, you don't have to be like an Oracle or anything.
Yes.
Just kind of recognizing the basics of SQL.
So the response is you're not going to be expected to write paragraphs. You're not going to be expected to know all the intricacies, but you should be familiar with the basic statements like select this from that or insert, and then he also talked a little bit about SQL injections, which we'll get to in a minute. So then, this is a minute later, we got into these attacks. We talked about CSERF, which is our cross-site request forgery, and that exploits the fact that your session with some website is still valid once you navigate to other websites. So the example in our class that we used was if you log into your account at bank.com and then go to a malicious site like rjaquino.net, and RJ has put a link on his site that says, that has a URL. And for this to work, the bank does have to have some pretty major security flaws. But say that the bank allows you to transfer money by accessing bank.com/transfer.php and then just specifying with the key value pairs we've seen, the person you want to transfer to, and the amount you want to transfer. So just by putting question mark RJ equals 1,000 or something along those lines, we could transfer $1,000 to RJ. So then if RJ puts a link on his site, that puts this link on his site, and we are already authenticated through these sessions on bank.com, then when we click the link, bank will say, all right, we have a session for this person, so you're authenticated, you are who you say you are, so you must really want to give RJ $1,000. Any questions on this topic? RJ wants to.
Yeah, so let me try to make that a little clearer. Like if right now, if you click a link to a Facebook photo and you're already logged into Facebook, Facebook will just bring you right to the photo, right? And if you're not logged into Facebook, Facebook will ask you to log in. So if I'm logged into Facebook and then I go to my email and someone's emailed me a link to a Facebook photo and I click it, I'll end up on facebook.com/photo?ID=something and I'm actually looking at the photo without having to log in a second time. And so this type of attack tries to leverage that websites, if you're already logged in, let you go to certain pages. And so the example here was that if a bank had a withdraw page or a transfer page, that someone could provide a link that when you click brings you to that transfer page and enacts a transaction for you. And so sites have plenty of ways of protecting against this, mainly require you to type in your password before you do any sort of transaction like that, or not have a link that does all these things for you, but that would be the type of attack. That websites conveniently let you stay logged in when you're not on the page through these cookies and sessions. So we actually did a whole section video on these sorts of attacks, and that was one example. So I hope that makes it a little clearer and how this works and what it's trying to do and why this type of hole exists. It exists so that you don't have to log in every time you want to go back to Facebook.com.
So then we moved on to data security, specifically instead of online security. And we talked about these ciphers. So Caesar cipher, Visionaire cipher, and then how we can break these ciphers using brute force attacks. Is there anything you want us to specifically cover on Caesar cipher and Visionaire cipher since we talked about it?
My thing was I just wanted to make sure that I knew the difference between the two.
Sure. So the Caesar cipher is when we just rotate each character with one key. So we might have some string hello, and then our key could be something like 3. And so then for every character in the word hello, we're just going to move it 3 characters further along in the alphabet.
Is that right?
You don't need to actually do it. I feel like that's a lot of pressure to put on RJ on the spot here. But then the way Visionaire cipher is a little more secure is by instead of...
Is that right?
I don't really particularly...
H-I-J-K-E-A-B-C-D-E-F-G-H. I got it wrong.
L-M-N-O,
and L-P-Q-R. So I've moved each one forward 3 spots in the alphabet.
So do we have any questions about that basic concept? Because that's very important for both of these types of security. So that's how they work. And then Visionaire takes it up another level. So instead of having one numerical key, we're going to have a word that defines multiple keys. And so the way this works is you could sort of think of it as a transition. First, instead of having one numerical key, we could have 3 numerical keys. So instead of the key 3, we could have the key 1, 2, 3. And so then our first, as RJ is drawing on the board, the first letter would be changed by 1, the second by 2, the third by 3, and then we would wrap around in our key. So then our fourth one would be changed by 1 again, and our fifth one changed by 2. And then the only addition that Visionaire cipher uses is instead of representing this key as 3 numbers, we represent it as 3 letters. So instead of 1, 2, 3, we would have the key ABC, and just say that A means 1, B means 2, C means 3. Any questions on how this works? Okay. And then brute force attacks is just when we try every single possible combination of something until it works. So if I'm trying to guess your password or trying to break your Caesar cipher, I'm just going to try rotating every letter by 1, and then by 2, and then by 3, which is why Caesar isn't as secure as Visionaire, because there are fewer possible ways we can rotate something using the Caesar cipher.
How many are there, Ben?
I don't know, approximately 25.
Try again, Ben.
You're really going to do rot 26? So you could rotate by 26 letters, but as we discussed in lecture, that would wrap you back around to the letter you're currently on and not provide much security.
No one would ever guess it.
Great, that's good. Next slide.
Sure.
Thank you. So this is an example of symmetric key encryption, in which the same key is used by both the sender and the receiver. So if RJ is sending me a message using the Caesar cipher, it's not much good unless I also know the key he used, how much to rotate it by. But then we also have some alternative ways that we can encrypt, things called using asymmetric key cryptography. And that's the example that Tommy talked about, and then we introduced these paint colors and really great demo. But essentially we just have people, every person has a public key and a private key. And if I want to send a message to RJ, I encrypt it using his public key, and then the only way to decrypt that message is with his private key. So once I encrypt a message using RJ's public key, he's the only one who is able to decrypt it. Did I make a mistake somewhere?
You just said public twice. I fixed it.
Oh, thank you so much. RJ's already fixing my mistakes. Any questions on how this works? So we use someone's public keys to do the encryption, and because they're the only one with their private keys, they're the only one who can decrypt the message. And so a lot of these systems are implemented using something called a trapdoor one-way function, something that's just easy to go in one direction but more difficult to go back. And the example we used was multiplying together 2 really big prime numbers to create an even bigger number. So it's relatively easy to take 2 big prime numbers and multiply them together to get one even bigger number. But once we have that really big number, it's hard to go backwards and find which 2 prime numbers could have been multiplied together to make it. Is that process?
Number, yeah.
Yes. Great. So then we got into some various types of malware. So malware is the umbrella term that encompasses all of these things, the viruses and worms and the adware, spyware, et cetera, that we'll talk about in a second. So viruses are a type of malware that require human interaction to infect a machine. So you have to open an email attachment, you have to download or run a file, do something that gets this process started. And once you do, then it's able to do damage, it's able to self-replicate by sending itself to people in your address book or something along those lines. Now, worms are a little different. They're able to self-propagate. Even without the human interaction, they can move to different machines. And the way they do this is by targeting security holes of computers on a network. Then we also, as a corollary to this topic, talked about botnets and distributed denial of services attacks. So because a worm can self-propagate, it can spread to many different computers on a network. And once it has control of all those computers, it's able to do some malicious thing on all of those computers. And one malicious thing we could do is launch a distributed denial of service, or DDoS, attack. And that's just an attack in which we all start sending a bunch of requests to one website, and the server is not able to handle all those requests and sort of shuts down, isn't able to provide web pages to the people who actually want to see the website. Does it make sense how we go from worms self-propagating to the creation of a botnet to the botnets launching a DDoS from many different machines? All those pieces fit together? Great. So then other types of malware, we have spyware, trojans, and adware. Spyware is just the name for something that steals information from your computer. An example could be a keylogger, which when put on a computer, like logs the keys that you're typing in. So maybe it notices that you're constantly typing password one because your password is password one, and now it knows. And a trojan is just spyware disguised as some useful piece of software. So like I download RJ's super amazing antivirus protection, but in reality it's not antivirus protection, it's spyware in itself. And then we also talked about adware, which is just another form of malware that displays unwanted advertisements on your computer. So how can we protect ourselves from this malware? We talked a little bit about antivirus software. We did a section video on it as well. And then we talked about some password security, like tips and tricks and ways to just make your password a little bit stronger. These things include just making it longer and not basing it on common words. So the reason for this is because in addition to these brute force attacks, hackers have, or crackers, or whatever it is we call them, have more sophisticated ways of accessing our data than just a brute force attack. So instead of trying just a random set of 8 letters, like P, Q, R, and then maybe some numbers 1, 3, 4, a smart attack program might try some common words or variations of those words before the random sequences. So it might try the word password before it tries XZWR. QXYZ.
Did you just say my password?
RJ's password is
XZWR.
QYZ.
QYZ.
So RJ has a very secure password, but my password, which is CSE1 password, is not secure. Any questions on why dictionary attacks are smarter than brute force attacks? Anything related to this? Great.
And on that note, they're smarter because like the most common password out there is password. Yes. The second most common password is, you know, like something username or something straightforward. Like if you Google the top 10 most common passwords, some of them are obscene, but most of them are regular words like password or things like that. One of my friends suggested that I put what as my password so that when it says, what is your password, I go, oh, thanks, and type in the word what.
And then we ended our discussion of data security with the topic forensics, just in the context of recovering data from a hard drive or even RAM, as we saw in that cool video where we were freezing RAM and then getting data off of it later. So the two questions that we sort of want you to answer for us are files deleted after we move them to the recycling bin? And then once we move files to the recycling bin, are they deleted when we click the empty trash button? So first one, if I move a Word document to the recycling bin, is it gone from my computer? No. No? The answer is no, not even close. I can just open up my recycling bin, click on it, opens up just like it previously did. What about once I empty the trash and I can't even find that file anymore? Still not deleted. How is it still there?
So basically it's kind of it's like the directory, you know, the entry is basically missing, like your computer forgets about it.
Perfect. So the answer was your computer forgets about it. So the directory entry is no longer there, but the bits remain unchanged. So our computer forgets about it, and at some point we might overwrite it, but for now, we left it intact, just forgot where it was. So if I delete a whole bunch of JPEG files, but then know how I can go back and use some forensic analysis to look for JPEG files, even if I deleted them, I still might be able to go back and find them. Any questions? Make sense? Great.
That information is still on the table of the files. You know,
the it's files. No longer in the table of files. So we've forgotten where it is. And so without forensic analysis, we don't have a way to get to it. But with forensic analysis, we can go and find that data still. Because it hasn't been cleared, we haven't set all the bits to zeros. They're still the same zeros and ones that made up the file before.
So there's actually special software that exists that allows you to recover files. Mm-hmm. So I used to work at the HUIT where people would come in with broken hard drives or malfunctioning hard drives where the computer wouldn't start up or files wouldn't open because something had gotten messed up. But the scanning software would go through and look for bytes that signal, oh, this is a JPEG here. And if it found this is a JPEG here, whatever symbols those might be, whatever sequence of zeros and ones those might be, it would then try to recover the JPEG file. And the file formats are such that if it can figure out what file format something is, it can reasonably recover the data. And so it would just scan through, you know, bit by bit or byte by byte looking for these special markers and trying to figure out, oh, what file is here? And it would come back with maybe 35 JPEGs out of the 70 that were on the computer, or maybe we'd find all of them, and maybe we'd come back with some more documents, and hopefully we'd recover, you know, the person's wedding photos or their senior thesis or whatever it might be. This won't be on the exam, but back up your data, please.
I think that's a reasonable thing to put
anything
on.
That's important, anything that you would miss if I came over to your computer and just took it, have a copy somewhere.
Does
and
that.
Have two copies. Because if you have one copy, then you're not really in that great shape, because once I lose your computer, you're relying on one copy. So personally, I just don't have that much data I care about. Most of it's music or photos or things. Or photos I do care about, but I have a copy of those. But just back up your data. That's maybe it will be on the exam. A question, should you back up your data? The answer is yes.
Short answer.
Paragraph response, why should you back up your data? 10-paragraph essays. No 10-paragraph essays. I'm not grading 10-paragraph essays.
Or anything. Privacy. Excuse me. Moving on to privacy. All right, we'll try to get the rest of our topics wrapped up in the next few minutes here. Moving one slide further.
Sorry.
No problem. So we talked about these two things, authentication and authorization. Authentication just being when you allow a user to log in via some other website. So you may have seen the login with Facebook or login with Google buttons. And that just uses some standard, such as OpenID, to allow you to not have to create a new account. So I don't have to create an account for randomwebsite.com. I can log in with my Facebook, and then Facebook can give that person some information that says, this is Ben Shryock. He is who he says he is. And then authorization, on the other hand, is when you give the third party access to some of your information, so such as your Google Calendar or contacts. And this usually displays on some screen that says, like, do you authorize Google to give this application access to your contacts and to your calendar? And it has a list of all the things that they're requesting access to. And then you can say, yes, I authorize this, or no, I do not authorize this. And the standard used for this many times is OAuth, or open authorization, I believe is what that stands for. Then we talked about tracking cookies, which are just a variation of cookies that are stored by some third party to track our browsing history. So the example we looked at was if ad.com is serving ads on cat.com and dog.com, and it sees we've been on cat.com. It sees we looked at one of their ads on cat.com, and later we go over to dog.com. So now it's going to say, this person's also interested in cats. The cookies that were just sent to me say that they were on cat.com, so now I'm going to display to them a targeted advertisement. Does that make sense, how we can use third-party cookies to generate information? People can track us a little bit. And could be used by advertisers to just create some targeted ad. Yeah?
I have a question. I'm still not clear on how it's able to interpret the cookie from the other website.
So,
That's from the company, from, like, for instance, the ad management company that works for dog.com and cat.com.
Exactly.
Right. So, what I'm saying is,
yes.
So is it just the URL that it interprets and knows,
So the question is, how does that ad server essentially interpret the cookies on both sites? Or how does it know?
Yes. The third party cookie, in other words.
Yes. So because it's
supposed to know one cookie, right?
Yes.
Which is the one that is on the network, the ad network. But the other one, how does it interpret that information?
So the answer is to how does it interpret these different cookies is it's one cookie, and it's one company, ad.com, displaying ads on two different sites. So you're right that its cookie is encrypted in a certain way. So when you see the ad on cat.com, it sends a cookie onto your machine. And then when that cookie gets sent back on dog.com or on cat.com, it's still the same company or the same third party with the same cookie. So they know how it was encrypted, so they're able to decrypt it. So it does have to be the same third party. There's not like some generic cookie for all third parties. But when you have an advertiser displaying on two different sites, it can just use the cookies it put on your computer on one site to then generate some targeted ad on another site.
You know, only ad.com can access the cookies for ad.com. So like, it could just be like sitting, you know, some session ID just like sitting there.
Okay.
You know, if I'm cat.com, I can't access the cookie for ad.com, but because ad.com is serving both of the
yes. Ad sorry, that's what I was trying to.
So to repeat for the camera, it's not necessarily encrypted, but ad.com in this scenario is the only one that can access ad.com's cookies. But because ad.com was serving content or serving ads to both cat.com and dog.com, it has access to all that information.
Yes. Apologies.
You're sending
yes.
the same cookie to ad.com, even though you're coming out two different
yeah.
sites.
So the same cookie is being sent to ad.com despite being sent from two different sites. Okay.
So you as a web browser, or you as a browser of the internet, is going to have one cookie per domain name that you want to send. So you have one cookie for ad.com. If you happen to be on cat.com, but an ad from ad.com is there, you're going to send that cookie. If you happen to be on dog.com and you're responding to an ad from ad.com, you're going to send the exact same cookie. And so that cookie is going to sort of build up this information and let ad.com know where you are.
Great. Thank you, RJ. Thank you, Tommy. So then we talked about server logs and analytics, which is just the sort of some ways that servers or webmasters can generate data about you and your browsing on their site specifically. So the server log is a file that stores maybe each URL visited on the site. So if you go to cse1.net/recaps, it'll store that, or cse1.net/lectures, store that. And it could contain things like the IP address, a date and time, or a user agent. And a user agent just being that string where we told a big story about how these user agent strings are just getting so much longer. But in reality, they just describe the web browser that you're using. And then we talked about analytics, which is just services used by website owners or webmasters to track more information and generate more interesting data. And this can be useful. So Tommy showed the example of Google Analytics. And then we talked about A/B testing, which is when we show one feature to some users and another feature to other users. For example, if Facebook wants to see if people like some new color, like if they want to make everything red, then maybe they'll show some users their classic blue background and some a new red background. And then they'll see if more people are visiting the site with the red background compared to the blue background, maybe they want to make the switch. Question? Okay. And then we talked a little bit about protection and how we can use a proxy server to hide our IP address. So a proxy server is just another step that we can add to this HTTP chain. So we send our request to a proxy server, and then it forwards the request on our behalf. And in that way, that's the server that we're eventually going to send this request to doesn't get information about our IP address because it's hidden by the proxy. Other things we can do in terms of general privacy are encrypt our hard drives, or encrypt our email using something called GPG. Fun fact, that uses the asymmetric key encryption that we talked about a little earlier. Yeah?
So I think one of the problem sets, so this problem about proxies and VPNs.
Yeah.
Relatively speaking, so what is the main difference between a proxy and a VPN? Can a VPN be proxy as well, or is it just because the tunnel is encrypted, therefore?
So if it's all right, the question was about proxies versus VPNs. I think we'll answer that in just a few minutes after we finish recording, just so we can make sure to get through everything, if that's okay. Thank you. So we talked about, I think, one of our last topics in this domain was cyber law, DMCA, which was a two-part act that spoke to copyright issues and anti-circumvention issues. Copyright just being that the owner of some software or some intellectual property or something along those lines has exclusive rights to reproduce and distribute and derive more products from their work. There is a fair use exception for education, parodies, things of that nature. And then the other part of this DMCA was the anti-circumvention portion, which prevents you from breaking into protective software. So things like your DRM protection on iTunes files or certain music files, you're not supposed to crack that. Or programs like Adobe Photoshop that might allow you to use them for free for some certain amount of time before having to type in a product code. Breaking into that system, entering a fake product code, is not okay based on the DMCA and by general ethical guidelines. So then our last topic was design, which if we'll move one slide further, we started out just talking about the principles of CRAP, which stood for contrast, repetition, alignment, and proximity. So these are important things. Contrast can be not only color, but also things like shape, size, and typography, and are often used on various website elements of the website just to make them more usable. So you might make your sidebar, because that's used for navigation, a stark contrast from the page's actual content. Then repetition, just repeating elements like a logo or a header, can help build a brand name. So I just downloaded an app called Mood Panda, and their logo is a panda bear. So on the front page, there's a panda smiling at you. And then on the loading screen, there's the same panda's face in place of one of the O's in Mood. So they constantly put in this logo on different pages of their product to build the brand. Then alignment is just you've all left aligned or center aligned something in a Word document maybe. So that's just the placement of elements. And in our Facebook example, we saw how that can create a visual hierarchy and some structure on a page with a lot of information. Then we talked lastly about proximity, which is a visual grouping. So if you have an article displaying on a page, you're going to put the picture corresponding to that article close to the text of the article and close to the title of the article and the author, just so that when you take a quick glance, you see that those are grouped together as opposed to corresponding to different things. So then we talked about typography, and this is important just in the fact that Tommy loves typography, so probably will be disproportionately covered, maybe between 95 and 100% of exam questions. Yes. No, we didn't cover too much, so we'll just talk about it quickly. I guess it speaks for itself. You can take a look at the recap for some more information, but some major points were serif versus sans serif, whether or not fonts have those little edges or flourishes on the edges of the characters, monospace fonts in which every character takes up the same amount of space, then some various descriptors of a font, like baseline, midline, how big various parts of the letters are, and then the amount of spacing between lines or characters, and then kerning, which I think is actually really cool. So look back at the recap for why that's important. Then our last slide for this presentation is about usability heuristics. We just talked about a list of 10 of these heuristics, which are just rules of thumb that we can use when designing a UI. And these include things like matching to the real world. So iBooks uses a bookshelf so that we don't have some new unfamiliar user interface, but instead have something we're used to seeing. And then other things like allowing for keyboard shortcuts to make your UI efficient, and then allowing people to use the mouse to make it flexible. Just general things like that that give people a good UI. We won't ask you to list all 10, but if you are curious, they're covered in the recap. So then I think we briefly want to cover CSS.
I got one question via email, and I'll be sure to write up a longer bit about this. I'll add a couple slides to this presentation before it goes online. But the question was, what does the dot mean in CSS? When do you use a dot versus a hashtag? And a dot in a CSS selector means class. So if you want to find something with the class button, it would be dot button, and then whatever CSS rules you want to be applied to your buttons. If you wanted to find the CSS element with the ID, my button, then it would be hashtag my button, and then the rules. So again, dot means a class, so multiple elements might all have the class button, and then dot button, everything would apply to that, whereas the ID field in an HTML element would be a hashtag in the CSS. And I'll be sure to add a few slides, or grab a few slides from the lecture notes, that that really should provide concrete examples of that.
Did we have another question about CSS?
Not that I remember.
Okay. Are there any last questions we can answer before we let you go?
And let you go simply means turn off the camera and you come up here and ask us questions.
Yes, precisely. Well, great. Thank you very much for sticking around, for watching online. We hope that this was useful. And if you do have any questions, please post to discuss, answer each other's questions, and we'll be frequenting the forum to answer your questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you.